We are talking with Frederick. We're going to continue our conversation here about the secret war on human consciousness and getting to some of the ideas that Frederick have regarding, you know, solutions and some of the things that could begin to resemble how to kind of get out of this mess that we've gotten ourselves into, as Frederick described, though this has been going for a long time. And if this is a creature of habit, then it's definitely more difficult to get out of it. It's not something that's going to be achieved overnight, but maybe it is. If it is an individual change, and if people actually begin to live as they want to live and do the right thing, maybe it could be changed overnight. If we look at some of these, you know, conflicts that we do have, Frater, the question is how we can live, you know, together, either with them or without them. I mean, if that's the point, as I said before, if this warring mentality is part of human nature, you know, how do we go around that? How do we live with it? But if that is the problem, who do we blame here? Is it the people who fall for this, to go along with it despite their, you know, will and their wishes? Or is it the people who manage to outsmart the other people, fool them to go along with, you know, their shenanigans? What's your view on this, Frater?
Well, that's a really good question as well. I mean, I think there's part blame on both sides there, and then there's those who ignore the reality, the ignorance, you know, the ignoring of the truth, the inaction too. I mean, you got to consider the responsibility there, I think. So there's those who would work against the best interests of humanity because either they're mercenary, selfish motives, or they're misled. There are those who are completely buying into it, you know, per se, wholesale. And then there are those who ignore it, just completely, you know, that's not my problem. It doesn't affect me. It's not going to happen in my lifetime. I hear that commonly from people when I try to break down the possible scenarios of all this. It's always, well, that's not going to happen in our lifetime anyways.
It's funny because to me, it's like to be able to, let's say, talk like that, to be able to have an informed choice with that attitude that, okay, I'm going to, you know, live my life as I want to. I'm not going to be dragged into all these other, you know, external problems of the world. If you don't do that with an awareness of what really is going on, then you're not going to be able to run from it. You're not going to be able to escape it. It's going to come knocking at your door. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, you know, the people that want to go off and live off above the tree line, Jeremiah Johnson fashion or whatever. I mean, you know, you might get away with that, but eventually there's somebody's going to come knocking, you know, and you get yourself far, far away from everybody else. You're going to be all on your own then, you know, and that's not necessarily a position of power, you know, to be isolated. Ask the people in the frontier back in the 19th century how that worked out, you know, because a lot of them got killed, you know, and that's the. But I understand. I certainly understand. I understand the desire. I went through that myself. I went off into the wild, thought I was going to go live up in Alaska when I was in my early 20s in the 90s. Why? Mm-hmm. Because when posed with this world and all the responsibilities of that are way down on one individual awareness, and then the desires from within combined with reconciling the experience from without, and just it all was so overwhelming. I understand the desire to run away.
Oh, yeah.
But I know also that we're all, I mean, I'm invested in this reality. I really am. I'm here. I'm part of the three dimensions. You know, I'm involved in this. So I have children too. It's hard to just ignore the future if you have a stake in the future. I don't want my children to be slaves any more than I want myself to be, or my wife to be a slave. You know, but
yeah, of course, yeah.
In many ways, I feel like we already are, and we all can feel that because of the, you know, economic servitude that we're all basically forced into. I don't know how. But one of the reasons why, for me, it was a hard experience growing up in our society, because at first I could not reconcile myself to this and be okay with it. So for a long time, I just rebelled against the reality as I understood it. And I paid a psychic price for that, a social psychic price for that, because people outcasted me for railing against, you know, what everybody's sentiments were, mostly the normal idealistic consumerism flavored with the quasi-religious patriotism that is America, you know what I mean? And I couldn't swallow that pill and had a hard time. And so I paid a big price. But then eventually I found my, you know, my wife and fell in love with her and we had a family. And all of a sudden now I've got a vested interest in reality. It's not just a kid who's just being rebellious. All of a sudden I'm a father with authority and I have to, you know, provide some sort of vision of our journey here as this family experience goes, you know, all the typical stuff that a person would get involved in thinking about if they had that kind of situation. And then in the wake of that, when you asked me at the beginning of the interview, how did this all manifest, this thesis of the secret war on human consciousness? Well, it was a life journey, like I said. It was a voyage of discovery. I didn't know when I was early, you know, in my early adolescent years, I didn't know all the reasons for the rebellious nature I had. I didn't have all the evidence yet, but I had the sense that I wanted to resist this system innately, intuitively, but I didn't know why. You know, I didn't know what was really wrong yet. But now I know. Now I can tell you why I wanted to resist that system. And it's very clear. And getting back to the conversation, you know, we just got done in the first hour looking at this tour de force of military history in America. And we looked at how, you know, the military industrial complex was born, rose up, and started basically captivated the American populace with compulsion schooling and its own bastardized education system that was basically a combination, a hybrid of a Prussian schooling system mixed with the American agenda, you know, as provided by Horace Mann and the other New England teachers there who started this ball rolling, I guess. But I'll tell you what we know also. We know that misdirection is continually, it's in our media and our education today. It alone works so effectively to distract the American psyche from the true state of reality. That's what we're going to talk about the second hour. You know, the idea, it may be considered idealistic, naive, or otherwise to think in terms of the metaphysics, but I can only speak to you about my experience. And I have always had an active imagination. I loved playing role-playing games when I was a kid, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like that. So my mind is a fertile ground for high idealistic notions and maybe even fantastical notions per se. But putting, you know, just making that a qualifying remark, you know, I really honestly believe that we are being misled to believe in this classical romantic existentialist idea, this angst that we have within us of a supposed or perceived separation and disconnection from reality, which, as I have discovered in my own understanding and I've found in the works of other great minds throughout time, human history has discovered, that we are surrounded, in fact, by a form of Philip K. Dick coined the phrase VALIS, V-A-L-I-S, VALIS, and it stands for Vast Active Living Intelligence System. I think that's a great definition. That's really what I believe. We are surrounded by a matrix, if you will, a field, an electrical field of intelligence that surrounds us and it connects us all humans, all thinking things, all, you know, all beings with consciousness are connected at a higher level, in a divine awareness, if you will. But I think that our signal, like with computers, like wireless, you know, devices, our signal's been bottlenecked. That's the term they use in the industry for cable term, bottlenecking the signal, which, if you can imagine a bottle, I can squeeze the signal down into a very narrow bandwidth so that it's just the basic operating system. You know, you can't really open up a lot of platforms and applications. We can just give you the basic processor. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Keep us all in that state. And I think that's what's happened. And I think that, you know, I don't think that all hope is lost, though, because I think in spite of all the mind control and all the social engineering and all the, you know, Prussian schooling and quasi-religious patriotism and all of that, the consumerism, in spite of all of that, I believe that divine consciousness, by whatever definition, whatever label you want to give it, continues to reach out to us as individuals and as a species collectively. And we make contact with it daily, whether we perceive it or not. And this falls into the realm of the work we did in the Sync book, Volume 1 and 2. I wasn't involved in Volume 1, although I read it and really digested the material, and then I was asked to write a chapter for the Volume 2, and there will be a Volume 3 that I've been involved in helping to bring other writers on board to continue that vision. But the whole idea of synchronicity and synchromysticism, something that Freeman and Jamie talk a lot about too, when they talk about their Slack Magic, which is part of their the Weird Stuff magazine that they produce. The whole idea is it's kind of like the Celestine Prophecy in a way, sort of could be considered quasi-New Agey, but in the end, I see it as merely deriving greater meaning from otherwise seemingly unrelated events and stimuli. And in many ways, I think it's the little things. I'll laugh and joke with people when they ask, how come you don't ever seem bored, man? And I'll say, because I have a rich inner life.
Yeah.
It's impossible to be bored when you have a rich inner life.
Of course.
You know, I mean, and maybe, you know, you could think of me as schizophrenic or something. I don't know. But I managed to derive greater meaning from seemingly unrelated events and, you know, meaningless events. But to me, they form a tapestry of awareness in reality that is transcendent. And this is, for me, it's a method to make some sort of mystical connection. Mystical being the word mystic is one who seeks union with the divine. So mystical connection with what I recognize as a balance between the sacred feminine and the sacred masculine as forces in the universe. And why is that something I focus on? Well, because we are all male and female. There's a feminine and masculine, you know, aspect to reality at all times. And it's part of our language. It's part of, I mean, you see it all over. The gender is one of the seven principles of natural law. I mean, it's just part of the aspect of understanding and decoding reality. And so I believe that's one of the reasons why we have such an issue with inequality between the sexes, and why the sacred feminine religiously has been suppressed and repressed, and why in our consciousness we have this whore, defiled female kind of archetype that is presented to everyone as a counterfeited version of the feminine, you know?
Yeah.
And within Freemasonry, we talked about this last time, how people suspect that Freemasonry is a cloaked goddess religion.
Right.
I can understand why people think that, because the sacred feminine is so greatly represented within the Freemasonic ritual, whether they want to acknowledge it or not. Why is that? Because I believe that our consciousness seeks the feminine, especially in an imbalanced approach to reality like the one we have now.
Mm-hmm.
The one-sided approach to reality where the patriarchal has been foisted above everything else. You know, the authoritarian, obedience-based patriarchal system that we were all raised under, that's the model. That's the method. And therefore, let's suppress the feminine. And what does it do? It creates an imbalance within our species, because look, they looked at, like you said earlier, they looked at the tribes. They saw the source of strength. You know where it was? It was the balance between the males and females. The European tribes of Europe, the Celtic tribes, a lot of the males and females fought side by side. Same with the Viking tribes. I mean, these people, they knew about the balance of their community. Male and female were one, you know, and that had to be stopped, you know, that they had to divide up.
I don't think that they even had that. They didn't even have that like idea about it. They didn't even think about it in that way. I think that we, you know, with our socially conditioned mind and our engineering, we're constantly asked to draw attention to certain things. But then on top of that, we're asked not to see the difference between them. So, for example, it's always pointed out about racism, but you know, you can't think about it. It's always pointed out about the differences between gender. So they bring the attention to it, and then they make a thing out of it, so that you become to think about it. I think in the past, this was just a normal approach. It was what it was. It wasn't a bigger kind of box that you put this in, you know, within your own mental space. That, oh, that's a, you know, that's this way and that's this way. I mean, of course, there's an awareness and a knowledge of what it is, but it wasn't, the distinction, I think, wasn't made in the same way. Therefore, there was a natural approach and a natural balance that arose from that type of mentality.
I think that's an astute observation. I would agree with that, you know. And I think that, you know, so basically, I spent a lot of time personally looking at things from the perspective of, you know, the Gaian hypothesis, for lack of a better term, you know. But that's not to say that I think that's the only way, you know. It just, for me, the idea of like a sacred earth mother goddess archetype works in concert with the idea of a male, the sacred feminine, a sacred masculine as well. But it's not it's not something I would present as this is the way it you know, this is the way you should think about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just what works for me. It's preferential. We all have, that's just how I'm wired. Like I spoke about this, I think last time on your show, or maybe not, but you know, all approaches to spirituality or religion, they're like different formats, you know, operating systems. You have your Macintosh or your Windows. I mean, they all decode the signals and the impulses and the transmission, but it's just in a different language, you know, and they do the same job processing the data, but they just have a different format. And so for me, this is what works. But, you know, there are those who would say, oh, the hypothesis, the Gaian hypothesis is another elite sanctioned and subsidized subterfuge of COINTELPRO or the intelligence agencies in Tavistock. And I can't speak to it either way. I could easily be convinced that those people and those characters would be employing these techniques wherever possible. But that gets me back to that hammer analogy. Just because a hammer can be used to do wrong doesn't mean it's not a useful tool. You know, so it really is important, I think, for us to not throw the baby out with the bathwater, as the saying goes.
Yep.
And so, you know, basically, guys like John Lash from MetaHistory.org, who's been on your show, I mean, he breaks it down very succinctly, the idea that humanity is thoroughly indoctrinated and imprinted with the teachings and outlook of what he calls the Abrahamic religious meme. And for me, that was huge. When he first broke that down back in, well, I think I heard it in 2005 or 2006, that was a huge moment for me, because I suffered from the after effects of being processed through that Abrahamic religious meme and coming out pretty disturbed on the other side about my own immortal soul, the condition of my own immortal soul, you know, in the afterlife and eternity and all this stuff. And I mean, boy, right. It took a lot to undo the damage done to my psyche there, you know, as far as like, just, you know, I'm sure you can relate. And so, as we all can in the West, because whether you were brought up in a religious home or not, it's still you're still posed with the question, are you saved one way or the other? You know, and you have to consider what that means, you know. And so I realized that on the most fundamental level, that this what he pointed out to me was something I'd already realized, but I didn't know it. He put words to the experience. And what I realized was that the reason why I rejected the church more than once was because I sensed on a very intuitive level that it was an elaborate thought-stopping mechanism or meme that was embedded within our world as a method of keeping people from truly thinking for themselves, for thinking about what they're being asked to do, which was mostly, if you look through history, the things they're being asked to do are usually inhumane or genocidal in nature, you know, and whether it's be like genocidal against the whole entire planet, you know, or whether it's just against the species of humanity. And so the only way to get around that was to engage people in what he called this classic victim perpetrator mind control program, which effectively weakens any resistance to that, you know, exclusive inhumane mindset, and would create, you know, that's obviously manifested, as we've already spoken about, through the strictly hostile patriarchy, or what I could call a one-sided approach to all life on earth, to reality, you know. And the thing about the religion is it's self-perpetuating. It goes through generation after generation. And it doesn't even matter if we don't get all the specifics right, because we could just create another denomination. That's just fine.
Right. Yeah.
It's actually good. That's good. We want as many versions of this as we can get.
Yeah, you know? An internal struggle strengthens the various groups that's within it. So you not only fight with other religions, but you fight within the religion. Is it Protestant or, you know, which version is it? Catholicism, you know? So
it's like spiritual sparring camp too. You know,
that's
so
right.
Later on, you can fight your other enemies with the same techniques you developed to destroy your own detractors from within. Yeah, you know, it's really crazy. But this is the method. And then, according to Lash, this unbalanced approach guaranteed our species to suffer from what he called an acute desacralization, the removal and the devaluation of the sacred from our everyday collective and individual awareness, and even in more sublime states too than just regular everyday awareness. But basically, this discord locks us all as, you know, people, wage slave. Oh, you know, there's only really, you know, Henrik, let's take a moment to say this. My belief is there's only really two kind of people in the world. You can call this classist if you want. My belief is only two kinds of people in the world. The first person is the person who has to work. Who has to work. They have to work for a living. They have to do something to work, to earn their food and their house and their everything they need. They have to work. And then there's the people who don't. And that's it. There's just two kinds of people. There's people who have to work, which make up most of the population of the Earth, and then there's the people who don't have to work.
Well, let me ask you this then, from that perspective. I mean, whether we want it or not, as human beings, as we're born into this system, it is a fight for our survival. I mean, everyone has to work to be able to live. I mean, all I can go from is what we see in the natural world and the natural environment, because there's far too much strange and wrong with the human beings, you know, either they're an anomaly or they are truly part of the system, but we've some way through behavior kind of set ourselves outside of that. But nonetheless, whatever you look at in nature, they have to, if they want to stay alive, that is, if they have a drive to be there and want to be there, they will need to work for it and fight for it. It doesn't mean that they don't have leisure time and have good times and, you know, play and everything else, but at the root of it, we are, as we're bound within the human body or any body on this planet, we'll need to sustain it and have sustenance for it. And that's just the way it is. There's nothing we're ever going to escape, right?
Well, I think that's a great distinction. But when I talk about work, I'm not talking about that subsistence survival and like you said, even room for leisure. I'm talking about working for credits in whatever monetary system it is to secure your living, to secure your needs on a consumeristic level. You know, like through the exchange of my effort, I have to get, you know, I'll give my effort, my passion, my energy. You'll give me money and I'll buy my food and my heat with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that to me in our modern Western world, there are those who have to do that and usually at a pay cut. And there are those who don't. Like when they wake up in the morning, they've already inherited millions or whatever, or they don't have to do that. It's already there, you know?
Sure.
So they may choose to do effort. They may choose to create. They may choose to do things, but it's their choice. At the end of the day, they could also choose not to, and they would still survive. So there's the distinction, you know, but you mentioned leisure. I think it's interesting. If you look at like the old books, when Columbus and the conquistadors first started rolling into the colonies, they all report in the diaries how all these natives are so lazy. They kept saying it over and over again in their diaries. Oh, the natives, this is one book I have, Conquest of Mexico. It talks about that, the discovering conquest of Mexico. And also this other People's History of the United States has excerpts of Columbus and the sailors on his ship's diaries.
Mm-hmm.
The People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. But in that book, they talk about how lazy the natives were. They weren't lazy. They weren't lazy. They were in leisure mode because all their needs were met. And they didn't have to like toil to pay taxes, you know, and toil for insurance and, you know, utility costs and all these other shakedowns that modern state society imposes upon people.
Mm.
So what the conquistadors and the Europeans coming over saw as sloth and laziness, I see as they were in an ideal mode, that they were doing what they wanted after all their needs were met. They, you know, they're like, you know, happy.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, that's just a little aside.
Sure,
so
sure.
Back to the point, though, is that, you know, once again, this discord that occurs from the desacralization, from not finding the sacred in the everyday life, I think it locks us into this routine patterns of mediocrity, you know, outright captivity, just the narrow bandwidth of sensory materialism, where, you know, we're just metropolis, you know what I mean? Like off mm-hmm. to the factory, off to the salt mine and back. And that, you know, I don't know how many people that I know that I grew up with in my back in the East Coast of America in the small little New England town I come from, who were, you know, these were kids that were filled with dreams and aspirations and stuff, you know. And I'm 43 years old now, so we're all grown up. And when I would come across them in modern time, you know, in the present day, that spark was gone in their eye, you know, over and over again. A lot of them are taking pills just to get out of bed in the morning, just to face life. And, you know, it's really remarkable to me. This is the evidence of this lack of the sacred, if you know, this devaluation of the sacred in our everyday reality. And Manly P. Hall, famous writer, researcher of occult and esoteric subjects, he said that we have lost the sublimity of the everyday. And as a result, we cannot satisfy our imaginations, nor can we nourish the idealism of our constitutions. And from this, we find the idea of the wasteland. And this is something I talk about in the article. I quoted from Joseph Campbell, Creative Mythology, talking about what the wasteland is and the idea that the wasteland is basically a reality that's patterned by authority, patterned by the the control model that we've been discussing and examining in our conversation today. This control model patterns everything, even art, you know, poetry, music, all pattern. Look at the music today. I mean, look at I'm talking about pop music, you know, there's plenty of great modern, you know, new music, but I'm talking about the generic pop, bubblegum pop music that we have. I mean, it's so, so commodified. It's the word I use, you know, I don't even know if that's a real word. it's such a commodity. It's such a consumer tool, you know, a marketing tool. And so basically
it's a social engineering tool as well on top of it with all the behavior of all these, you know, so-called singers and, you know, what have you. It's turned perverse. I mean, the garbage that's within this now, it's just unbelievable.
they have to come up with new and exciting ways to coerce the consumer into the buying the products and to maintaining this inhumane stance on reality. I mean, that's where the idea, you hit it right on the head with the people that are marketing the products on the television and the movies. They build an emotional bond with the viewer. There's an emotional attachment to the product. There's an emotional investment in this idea of me and my product, me and my consumer item, you know? And so the context is the only way we'll think it's important is if it's attached to an emotional response. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how, and we will buy anything if we have an emotional attachment to it. Think about it. The novelty. I mean, collectors, the perfect example, people who collect stuff, they will collect anything if it's got some sort of like emotional, usually some memory of a childhood memory or something that's fueling it. So it's all fueled by memory is completely wrapped into emotion. It's imprinted on our brain. I think emotion is the vehicle by which memory is imprinted on consciousness. You know, one of the vehicles, because electricity and water being the other two, you know, but emotion, the feeling attached to the event is what really holds it in our minds, you know. And so they take that, you know, these are people who have studied the mind for decades. Marketing is a science. So sure. They know, they put little electrodes on people's heads and they make them watch TV and they know which part of their brain lights up from what they're seeing on the screen. And they've got it all figured out and they know what we'll respond to, you know. So, and it's worked and it keeps working. So basically, you know,
and I
what
think,
do we do?
Sorry to interrupt that, but I also think one of the reasons why that does work so much at this stage is because we don't have our inner life awakened. We have, as you said before, that are desacralized our everyday life, and we're no longer in contact with that source. So we're looking for that source externally, and as some of these brands have shown, they get a cult like following, like you know Apple and stuff like that. It turns into a religion, and you're craving that. You know, external things that you know will gratify you because you have a spiritual emptiness within you, and ultimately this is because we have not, you know, awakened to these aspects of ourselves. We've fallen asleep effectively.
Yeah, it's like with sports enthusiasm. I mean, you're giving up your responsibility for identity and let the team identify you. Let your home team or your home product or your home brand, let it define, you know, reality for you and let it determine for you whether you're happy or not. Oh, the game, the team won or they lost. That's going to determine whether you're happy or ever seen anybody that's a sports enthusiast the day after their team loses. I mean, it's just like, it's a sad day, you know, it really is.
Yeah.
And it's a really remarkable thing. You know, we're talking about a sports team here, you know, but you know, this is so a part of it. Like you said, it's all connected to awareness. Because listen, we are being convinced that it's okay to act inhumanely for the bottom line. You know, we're being convinced that that's just fine. But on a deep and spiritual level, it's diminishing our dignity, our own personal dignity. And when people are challenged in the moment, like you said, if they're not aware, if they have no inner life, if they have no greater understanding of the big picture, they're not going to perceive why something is out of order. And when they feel any emotional reaction to something being out of order, they'll just assume it's that same old discord they already feel because, you know, they're already in a dystopian state. And they already feel like things are uneasy. So why not just go out and get some more of that product that makes me feel good, you know?
Yeah, I wonder what our what our natural state would be like. And I think it would be very different. I think one of the big complaints I have you know, currently is that things are very, very homogenized, and it's very much in one way. I mean, wouldn't it be great if there were actually indeed different countries in the world that had different properties, and you could choose where you wanted to live or under what conditions, or you know, all of this, and then we could see what happened from there. But the way that things have been so much, you know, uniformly just you know, attached to this one idea of how things should be run is absolutely ridiculous. And I think that the manipulation as well, Frater, of the human race, I kind of see that as a that analogy of the genetic manipulation of a fruit fly. They did this test where they tried to remove the eyes of the fruit fly, and they discovered that they managed to do it, but basically only for a short period. I think within a generation or maybe two removed from that original manipulation, the eyes started to grow back again on the fruit fly. I mean, David Icke has done this analogy of basically humanity being as a, you know, a ball filled with air that you have to hold it under. They're holding it under water, but as soon as you let it go, it will pop up to the surface again. And this is the system that they have in place right now. It needs constant maintenance. Every generation that comes in, as you said before, has to go through the system of schooling, the system of indoctrination, and it's something that they have to keep up. So it's not a natural state. But as soon as that you know, manipulation is removed, I think a lot of other interesting things would happen with the human race, both good and bad, I think.
Yeah, it's not going to be an easy trip either way. It's going to be a long walk back too. But I'll tell you.
Yeah,
I'll tell you though. I think you're right in that. Really, David Icke has a great way of stating it simply, I think, and giving a good working picture, because that's it. And that's what I was talking about earlier, about the persistence of reality. No matter what the social engineering, no matter what the mind control, no matter what you put me through or put any of us through, humanity will still defy the norm. And we'll still embrace novelty, which is our only hope, I think. But we will embrace the novel. That we will just find something in something that nobody else sees, but it means something to us, and it will divert us from something that other people are trying to make us do. You know, and that's a good thing. That's a good thing that we do that, because that's our only hope. I mean, I sometimes dream of how this is all going to unfold, and I see that the true hope lies in the wild humans that scurry off into the woods. You know what I mean? Like, that's where our only hope for our species is going to be in the future, I think, sometime.
Well, if the rest of them goes into this transhuman merging with some kind of AI system, then yep, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, right. And like these blanketed Wi-Fi zones where, you know, there'll be a time, I think, where you just enter a town, you know, you cross over the border, and you'll automatically, your consciousness will be uploaded to the matrix of the town, you know, and they'll be following you from that moment forward. And, you know, and that's I heard one time Bill Gates talking to the software engineers of America before he retired from Microsoft. He said the vision 2020 for the future of Microsoft was the child waking up in the morning, activating their MySpace wall page and stepping in for the day. That's their vision for us.
You know, there you go.
And so, you know, back to the points here, where, you know, Lash, I keep mentioning him because he's got a great understanding, I think, of not only the present condition, but some serious solutions. And for him, our only hope is to contemplate the animation of that material and sensory world that we find so mysterious, which is all around us, you know, but we're seemingly disconnected from, is to move into deep rapport with this mysterious source of life by just going out into the woods sometimes. If you don't live in the place where you can do that, you know, there's parks and cities and there's relatively open air, you know. I mean, I know it's not easy, but the idea, this is just from my perspective, the idea of reconnecting on the deep level with life on some level, this is the key. And Lash also uses the term biomysticism, or the empathic and visionary participation in the life force. This was a term that was, you know, gnosis, I believe, is what this was defining, a method of direct access to the physics of the cosmos through the instrument of our bodies, the five senses and beyond. And what our old friend Wilhelm Reich, Austrian genius Wilhelm Reich, said, the biophysics of perception. And this alone, I think, is a concept that people should consider. If anything that we're talking about today is moving you, then take a look at this idea of a biophysics of perception and the idea of infusing imagination with sacred elements as you understand them. And that's the key thing, is working with your own intuition. People so often are being convinced to give up your authority and let somebody else define reality for you, whether it be the authority at the front of the room, you know, the lecturer, the teacher, or the instructor, or whatever. And, you know, of course there are experts in fields, and of course there are people who do a lot more footwork than others, but in the end, isn't life for the living? Aren't we supposed to experience things? And then doesn't that mean that sometimes you make a mistake and fail and fall down and get up and keep going?
Well, of course, you know.
Yeah. The idea is to look within and trust your instincts, you know, and that comes, okay, so you don't just, like, if you feel like you're an imbalanced person right now, you're not going to just, okay, I'm just going to start trusting my instincts from this moment forward. No, but you can take steps to reintegrate yourself and get to a place where you are in optimum awareness of yourself and your motives and in the reality around you. And then once you've reached that place where you feel that confidence, you trust your instincts to maintain your stance in reality. And this is a lifelong procedure. It's not an easy trip. That's why it's so easy to go the other route, which is just buy into the myth, you know, and just drink the Kool-Aid and get on the bus. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
But in the end, I keep coming back to this idea of restoring the mythical and mystical patterns of human experience in our reality through the methods that I've learned and looked at, like the idea of synchromysticism, the idea of synchronicity, the idea of perceiving and embracing the notion of a matrix of sorts, you know, of an earth matrix, if you will, not the matrix that we, you know, that enslaves us, but, and that's something I want to talk about too, is the differences between the systems of approach, because there are, listen, as I've already stated in the first hour, we're living in the aftermath of a species-wide hijacking of human consciousness. This is my belief. You know, probably, like I said, 10 to 12 or 13,000 years ago, one or more earth-shattering catastrophes knocked humanity's collective network or consciousness offline, as well as individual consciousness, creating this species-wide post-traumatic stress disorder. And it was in this weakened state that the human species was exploited. And a pathogen entered our field, a mind virus infestation of whatever the source. Well, I don't know, inner or outer species predator, but that thing, that infiltration understood the human mindscape. It still does.
Is it trauma itself? Is it fear itself?
That's what David Icke says, right?
Right.
I mean, and I find a lot of credence in that theory. You look at the Children of the Matrix and a couple other books. He talks a lot about fear having that persona, which would fit right in with the, you know, Judeo-Christian ideology of the evil and Zoroastrian ideology of evil and good and evil and all that. But I don't know. I know that fear is powerful.
I mean, because if it is an unconscious process, Frater, then it would know us even, you know, better than we know ourselves, and this is how it managed to perpetuate itself and use all the processes that we do have against ourselves, if you see what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. And that is the truth. It does know us better than we know ourselves, because it's already, the game's already afoot when we're born. It's already afoot. It's already been in place for generations before us. And so, you know, this collective disorder that manifested in the wake of a cataclysm or catastrophes has diverted enough of the human species away from the classic tribal hunter-gatherer subsistence life to the more rigid and planned city-state agricultural reality, with, you know, the authority being justified and reinforced by a select priesthood, which always is chosen for obedience and skill in perpetuating whatever the ruling paradigm is that's being offered to the people. That's who's put in place as a priest, is the most obedient and articulate one. And so
sure.
In the end, we're, you know, the species that this infestation of our species brought the entire system of human consciousness back online in what could be considered a veritable safe mode. Like when a computer crashes, it's a safe mode, so that just the most basic platform and applications are being run.
Yeah.
And it's a firewalled version of reality, not unlike the so-called Chinese model of the internet that we hear about, with its narrow bandwidth or frequency that can be easily manipulated, and people can be kept in just the approved areas of consciousness and awareness. And so, you know, going back a little bit, actually, it's going forward from this time, from this cataclysm time, but the I mentioned before about how two schools arose in Iran. There were two schools of esoteric knowledge, and both these schools employed the mystery traditions and techniques to their initiates, you know, to those who would adhere to their path, so to speak. Mm-hmm. These schools, one of them was the Illuminators, who would commence to instruct and liberate those who were initiated in the order. These were what was considered the fosters, or from phosphorescence, the light guides. And these people were like, you know, what you could think of as like a shaman guide who would help you through sometimes entheogenic means or other esoteric aesthetic means to realize your full potential, to fully integrate your own consciousness and awaken to your, you know, your destiny, whatever that may be, and set you on your path, and then you're good to go. This is what the Illuminators were all about. And then there was another school called the Illuminati, which basically used a lot of the same techniques and tools, only they developed a method of entrapping and enslaving the followers with a false light, and basically binding the adherents to a false reality, which usually manifested in the form of, you know, dead-end rabbit hole theories or simulated chaos, basically, you know, cul-de-sacs of information that would divert and otherwise keep a person preoccupied.
Yeah. It seems to me that some of the most ancient religions also understood, I think they even worked on the premise that you have a dichotomy, you know, to be able to produce a creative force, basically. I mean, in human basic mythology, we have these conflicts all the time of, you know, Osiris and Set, and ultimately the sun Horus, you know, fighting against Set. But I've heard it, you know, come up in different settings and different environments, but basically that you do have two teams. In a way, it is a kind of a dialectic. That's why the Hegelian dialectic actually works. It's because it's modeled on something that is a real natural principle on top of it. The fact that they hijacked that idea, though, to run their own creative force, if you will, is another story. But nonetheless, it seems to be that in the conflict, there is something that actually is useful for us. I mean, I believe this because otherwise I don't think it would be part of us. I mean, if indeed the universe or the creative force, the living system, whatever you want to call it, wants us to wake up, if we are indeed in a slumber, if we are to become awake, unfortunately, it seems like drama and conflict is one of the best ways for us, a slap in the face, if you will, to make us question ourselves and to examine our own behavior. So in a way, it is like we've done it to ourselves, but it's also a necessity. It's a reason why that exists in our world right now and today. And I think our refusal to kind of to awaken and to examine this and to try to break out of this hypnosis, it will keep on coming. It will keep recurring in our history, and it probably will grow larger and larger, like it did, you know, during certain conflicts during the First and Second World War, for example, because it is trying to force us to wake up. That's what I see, Frater.
Yeah, you know, and it's sort of hard to know how to feel about that, because I'm with you on the, in a sense, I like the idea that people resist things. I really do, you know, and so even if they're resisting solutions, it's like, it's a choice, man. We have free will, and sometimes I wonder if I think what you're getting to and what you just said is like, we shouldn't be too attached to expectations about the results, because we don't know where this trip's taken us.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
what I mean? And,
sure.
And who knows what's going to manifest? Who knows how this is all going to work out?
Or even what the true purpose of it is, right?
Yeah. What the true purpose of it is, which is why you get back to the idea that there's 1,000 paths up the mountaintop. You know, there's no one way to the divine. There's as many ways to experience spiritual reality as there are ideas about it. I mean, everybody has their own idea, and that's why I quoted the Buddha at the end of the first hour and the idea of doubt and find your own light.
Yeah.
Because it is a choice. We have a choice, and people are giving up their choice before they even start to play.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that's the reason why I'm here today, I think, and part of the message that I bring is because I believe that the choice is there. And I'm trying to reinforce the need in people to make the choice. I'm not telling you how to choose. I'm just telling you, choose. You know, live your life. Choose something. To choose something to believe in. You know, and this is what we're here for, as far as I'm concerned. The three great questions in life are, who are we, where do we come from, and where are we going? You know?
Yep.
And I think one of the things we're doing here is to choose through an educated, you know, experience, because we live life for a while, we see how things are, we see how we are, and then we choose how we're going to be from that point on. And, you know, we live in a complex world where information and ideas and signals are being communicated to us from all different directions. And we find that what we're being corralled into doing is thinking in terms of the, you know, the deadening uniformity of thought, you know, consensus reality that's predetermined and prefabricated, and we're just supposed to accept it wholesale, piecemeal, whatever. I mean, this is what we're being asked to swallow. The blue pill, right? So, you know, basically, the ideas that we're looking at right now in this conversation is that there are other paths that lie outside of this uniform, narrow bandwidth of perceiving reality. And some of the paths that I've walked down that I come to the table talking about because I'd hate to see them fade from reality are more of the esoteric ideas that deal with, you know, symbolism and allegory and myth, things that have been subjugated and relegated to, you know, fantasy and make-believe now in our reality.
Mm-hmm.
They used to be embraced as a far greater tool for understanding the world and our place in it. And it's been lost in the everyday authority-based teachings that we get from the school, where myth and things of this nature, symbolism and allegory, which are open to interpretation of the individual and how it may reflect on their destiny, can't be controlled. It's too much of a wild card. We can't let that in, you know? So what they have to do is excise it from the conversation. Take it out of it. It's not a part of the conversation.
Yeah.
And so we've suffered because of this. And the secret, the real secret in the room that's creating a gap in the web of communication between us all is that those things have not left the room. They're still there. We're surrounded by myth and symbolism and allegory in everyday life all around us. And usually it's being used to a disadvantage for us, against us, because we've seen, like with the work of David Icke and Freeman and many others, corporate logos and symbolism and how they're used to control reality. We saw, I believe, Lynn Picnic said on the one from the Stargate conspiracy, I believe she said on your show that the SRI Institute back in 1970 had already determined that Masonic and Egyptian iconography would be the method of shepherding American human society into the 21st century. I mean, it was already predetermined. And that's why you see all this Masonic and Egyptian symbolism all through the movies and TV and everything from 1970 up, and even before that, but especially from 1970, the year I was born, to today. In the newer movies, we just watched a movie the other day, a new movie where, once again, there's all this Masonic symbolism just blatantly staring you at staring at you from the screen.
Sure.
And
it's
why would they do that? Because it's captivating. That's why. And our species is under a spell, a vast global enchantment in the iron grip of sensory materialism. That's how it's all been conditioned. This experience, this so-called, you know, scientific observation and investigation is the new religion to the exclusion of all else. This ancient idea that the physical, you know, in the ancient times, people understood the physical reality is only part of creation. But that idea is lost to us. You know, that's why they had a word, metaphysical, beyond the physical. Meta means beyond. Beyond the physical. And this, beyond the meager frequency range of our five senses. So what we need to do, Henrik, I mean, this is my suggestion, my admonishment to those who would respond to our conversation, is we have to retrain our minds in order to view this greater reality we speak of, and to see through the false realities being shaped by cybernetic social engineering, mind control programs, transhumanist dystopian agendas, multimedia, virtual reality, all managed by what Joseph P. Farrell, who I know you know, it calls a breakaway predatory society, who's been foisting upon us the paradigm of closed energy systems, meaning that there's no free energy, and artificial scarcity and shortage, meaning there's only so much energy, so it's really expensive, you know?
Sure.
And this is the largest multi-generational mind control operation ever perpetrated with the, you know,
This is two-pronged, by the way, because it comes both from the, you know, the peak oil crowd and the, you know, the oil companies, and it comes now from the green movement as well, which we know has this tentacles in all of this as well. So, I mean, look at the universe. It's massive, and there is an endless amount of just bubbling energy out there. And here we're sitting on this rock who's like, you know, alive to the brim with things that are, you know, growing and you know, animals and everything you can imagine that has been on this planet in the past and is here right now. And yet we have, just as you describe here, we have a very, very limited mindset of what could be possible and achieved. And we basically, you know, nope, we can't do it anymore. We have to turn everything off, you know, because now it's we're entering into scarcity. It's what a mind game they've run on us, haven't they? Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, and it's basically a sort of a reverse engineering, trying to not only figure all this out, but then to plot a new course. And my experience has told me that there can be answers found in esoteric systems, occult sciences, mystery traditions, and all these are tools and devices for inviting transformative change in individual consciousness. And that's the definition too of magic that I like to work with. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the idea that magic by definition is, this is one that's put forth by guys like Lon Milo Duquette and another researcher, writer, John Michael Greer. And basically the idea is that magic is a system of compelling or causing changes in consciousness in accordance with will. That's a distinction from the method. You usually hear the definition being magic is a method of causing change in accordance with will, like change in the universe in accordance with will. But what I'm making a distinction is magic to me is about causing changes in my own consciousness in accordance with will, which will therefore lead to changes in the universe, because I'm a part of the universe. And so if I'm changing myself in my own consciousness, I'm having an impact on reality all around me. And then this is an interconnected idea or perspective that people are being trained away from thinking in these terms. But the esoteric occult systems and mystery traditions that have been here for thousands of years have pointed to this reality. They pointed to the greater hermetic axiom of as above, so below. the dichotomy between the greater and the lesser reality. And the idea that if we solve the problem of the lesser reality, that we will have a key to understanding the greater reality. And this is an individual idea that has been sort of like, you know, relegated away from us as unimportant to profit margin. And in the end, we end up with a situation like we have right now, the one we have. And I think that I keep harping on the idea of synchronicity and synchromysticism because it's helpful in to start the ball rolling and deriving meaningful patterns from what seems to be unrelated events in our lives. In the 21st century, there is, I believe, a techno-mystical transcendent loop that's going on where wisdom is passed out to the universe. It's offered to anyone who will grab it if it's there. And the point is that we need to be open to the idea of it. Our own recognition and belief that it's there plays a huge part in the reality. And that, I don't want to seem too new agey or the secret about this because I'm not trying to go that route. But there is something to the ideas of like the law of attraction as it was put forth in that movie, in that book, but not quite the way it was put forth there, I don't think. But what I understand is this. Consciousness and reality are interwoven in an intimate interaction with an energetic, holographic, and hydraulic universe, as in water-based, that our physical bodies are actually individual wet cell quantum processors, which are downloading every moment customized operating systems from the, you know, you could call it the supreme divine administrator of our cosmic, you know, consciousness network. And that, so each moment, we're downloading a version of ourselves. You know, this is the operating system Freighter X. You're the operating system Henrik. You know, that's the desktop we're working with. And within this quantum entanglement, this divine administrator is fabricating material existence upon a canvas of photonic plasma and empty space or dark matter or however you want to call it. And this is all going on every moment. And we're involved in this on a level beyond, I think, our understanding. Max Egan, I think you're familiar with him. He's got a website called thecrowhouse.com. He suggests, and this is back to that hydraulic idea, he suggests that conscious intelligence, cosmic or otherwise, transmits hydraulically through the medium of water, hydrogen being the original atom or particle of matter. Henceforth, the focus on global control and alchemical manipulation of the world water supplies and sources. Right now, I believe the Bush family and the Clintons, they own like one of the largest water aqueducts in like South America, really high up in the mountains. It's pretty remarkable that they're actually the ones who own this. It's one of the purest and largest sources of water in the world, and they own it. So, but Max posits that when one's bodily vehicle, our bodies, finally degrades and shuts down when we die, that the 60% of it that's made up of water is expelled and recollected by the Earth, by the Gaian matrix, and it effectively uploading the sum of our individual experiences back to the source of consciousness. And this is, in effect, a network upgrade that's assured with every passing. So it's like an amazing concept, but think about it. The water in our body, the 60% of our body is made up of water, encoded with our life experiences, our memories, our thoughts, our feelings. And then when we die, it falls back into the source and is uploaded into the vaporous, vast, active, living, intelligent system surrounding everything.
Yeah.
And this is an interesting way to look at things. And it's something that this is one of the examples of what a person can come up with who's enlightened. I mean, Max Egan's an enlightened individual, I believe. I've spoken to him many times, and I've interviewed him, and I've spoken to him off the record. And he's he makes humanity a better species with men like him around, and women too, who understand. They improve our species. They bring hope to me and others like it. I really feel like it's important to encourage people to go forth and to learn to creatively overcome the adversities of your everyday life, all the while realizing and locating, identifying, and keeping your eyes on the sacred in the everyday. And that when we encounter all the suffering and the struggles and the oppositions and the resistance and the fear we go through every day, that we can and will persist until the inevitable resolution, harmony, balance, integration, and transcendence follows, which I believe as an optimist that it will follow just like the rising sun every morning. And all the while, the universe will still be whispering to us when we're ready to hear it and telling us the great truths that we've forgotten.
Very nice. But now, also, as I see it, is the bottom line is that most of us do not exercise our free will, what we have, because I do believe that we have it to a certain degree. So, as I said before, certainly we're tied to certain functions of our organism, as you will, as it exists biologically and even spiritually to a certain degree. But we must begin to live how we want to, no matter what others say or what has been imposed on us or whatnot. We have to just lead by example. There's no one's going to take us by the hand, lead us down the road that we want to go or save us out of the situation, that we're in, whatever. I mean, if you're not pleased with something, the only one that's going to be able to change it is you. I mean, I watched a great movie last night called Still Mine, I think, from 2012, that shows this old, very capable man that basically ends up battling the government and their bureaucrats for his right or for his ability to build basically his own house on his own property. And it shows this very process of how he basically at the end ignores whatever they have to say. And it's allegedly based on a real story as well. It's a good one, but it shows how he takes the initiative. And the only mistake he made was that he went to the government in the beginning to begin the process of asking, for help ask for permission by them to do his own work, basically. But it's a good example. But this is, I believe, Freder, is the only thing that's going to take us out of it is that people begin to live as they want to live, because it's not going to be everyone at once that it's just going to happen like that. It just has to be individual, achievements. And this is what eventually is going to kind of open up this experiential bandwidth as well and take that back, as you talked about before, so that you get a true diverse life experience instead of this homogenized version that we have now.
Yeah, that's it. Non-compliance through creative and artistic expression.
Yeah.
That's our only hope, man, is that people, my good friend, and I know he's a friend of the show, Mark Passio, he talks about the initial civil right of all humanity is the prerogative to say no leave me alone. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, well, exactly. And today we don't have anywhere to go. There's no second option. I mean, as we said, the whole planet is spoken for, and there's nowhere you can. Well, there is, but you know, technically, there's nowhere you can go and just do what you want to do. Right? Everything is spoken for, so that's a problem as well.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been very good, Freddy. I think we should begin to round things up here for this time. Why don't you give us your website again and let know where people they can go to follow you a little bit more regularly.
Absolutely. And again, I really want to thank you for this opportunity to come on and to discuss the research. And I really, really enjoy your show. And I think you're providing a much needed and a top-notch service to humanity. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Your efforts and Lana's efforts and your whole team. I really appreciate what you guys are doing. And I really, I'm proud to be here and a part of it, you know, to be one of the people coming on and talking about this stuff. And so basically, once again, my website is Middle Chamber and the letters fx.wordpress.com, middlechamberfx.wordpress.com. And I want to also encourage people to keep looking at freemantv.com for more media there. And of course, thesyncbook.com for Syncbook Press, which is the ones that have produced the Syncbook Volume 1 and 2, and they're going to be publishing my book. Speaking of which, tonight, 11 o'clock Eastern Time, my wife, Mater X, my partner and best friend in the whole world and most amazing person, the most amazing woman in my world, she's going to be joining me on a little radio show they do over at syncbook.com called 42 Minutes, which is just, you know, a little conversation, and we're going to be talking about a lot of current events and different things that's going on right now in our current situation in the world, and as well as some new media projects that we're getting involved in collaboratively with some folks involved in the Syncbook team over there. So anybody wants to check that out, I believe that's going to be live, but it's definitely going to be podcasted too. So that's at thesyncbook.com. Now, I think that's about it, Henrik.
Very good. It's great to have you back again, Freder. Thank you for your time today. And we'll, of course, stay in contact, and we'll do it again down the road. Thank you.
Thank you, and bye-bye.
And as always, my friends, a big and warm thank you goes out to all our wonderful members who make our work possible and inspirational. We have some great programs for you coming up with Anthony Peak, Neil Kramer, Gerard Andringer from the Netherlands. Then we have Phil Stanford, and later Kingsley Dennis. Think free and stay clear. I wish you have a great weekend, and we will talk to you on Monday again. Take it easy.